Hello, heroes. Welcome to Modifier. I'm your host, Megan Dornbrock. Hello again. I'm not going to say too much as an introduction this time, since PK and I do go on for a while this episode, but I just wanted to say it was so fun to chat with him, and I am super excited to finally share this one with you guys. So let's get right to it. Well, thank you for chatting with me and being on the show.
Not a problem. I'm always happy to talk about my work and process and hopefully help evangelize the crazy little games that I help write.
Yeah, absolutely. You're getting to be old hat at this podcast thing, and process is what we're interested in. So I'm glad to hear that too.
Yeah, cool. Should be a good time.
Cool. So you are a game developer. You've done some work for the Firefly RPG. You've got Three Rocketeers out is the game that you've got out for people to download. The game that we're going to talk about, Heroes Fall. What else am I missing that people need to know about you?
So I'm also through Evil Hat Productions. They're the ones who publish Three Rocketeers. Mm-hmm. It's one of their Worlds of Adventure for their Fate Patreon. I am working on the Fate of Cthulhu.
Ooh.
For them. I am the lead developer on that. And Fate of Cthulhu asks the question, what if Skynet were the Elder Gods? So you have this action horror game where things are being sent back in time to change the past and then change the future. But they're not robots. They're horrible Squamous things. Wrapped up in human flesh suits.
Oh my gosh.
And the players are the ones who are trying to change the future for the better. And
So you can
play the Sarah Connors, the Kyle Reese's, the young John Connors. You could play the analog of Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator from Terminator 2,
wow.
Where like you have a conscience and you're trying to, like, even though you are corrupted, you are trying to change the world for the better. And we are doing our best to work out some non-deterministic mechanics for how the future changes. So you can do these things, and you will change the future, but you don't know how.
Oh, that's really cool.
That's really important to me for something that's, you know, Cthulhu-esque is, you should not be able to be like, well, we just have to check off A, B, and C, mm-hmm. and then the future is all bright and shiny and everybody's got a unicorn. Like, that's my goal, is to avoid the shiny, happy unicorn endgame.
Yeah,
because
that
doesn't fit for Cthulhu.
Absolutely not, no. Is that more the fate that they end up with, then, the way they change the world, is that more in the GM's hands, or how do you even determine?
So right now, the way we're working at it is it has a little bit of random mechanics.
Cool.
It comes down to a roll of the dice. Those dice can get assigned by the players, and then those dice sort of explode out and affect other things in the timeline.
Oh, excellent.
So no one's really sure.
Yeah.
Right. And then the GM is the one who does the explosion. of like, this is where all these other things, flew out and did weird things.
Awesome. That makes the GM role extra enticing, then.
Yeah, so we are still in early days of that, but it's exciting. We've had some really good conversations, and I think we have a good direction for it.
It sounds like, yeah. So definitely something to look forward to.
I'm playing backup developer, helping Rob Wieland on the Kaiju Incorporated RPG.
Okay.
Kaiju Incorporated is an upcoming card game and RPG from Evil Hat Productions. And the idea there is it's Wall Street
mm-hmm.
meets Pacific Rim.
Hmm.
So you have these giant multinational corporations trying to profit off of kaiju attacks.
Interesting. Okay.
And in the card game, it's all very cheeky. You play one of these multinational corporations and try to get the most money and research, but as you research things, your kaiju meter fills up and then kaiju attack and bad things happen, but then you get new products and blah, blah, blah.
Cool.
So that's pretty neat.
Are the cards like the products and the kaiju, or how do those?
Yeah.
Cool.
So the cards are split up between sort of industrial assets that you can purchase. So new factories, new headquarters, things like that, mm-hmm. new research facilities. The kaiju is just a stack that when the kaiju, someone's kaiju meter fills up, the top kaiju attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, there's those. There are product cards that you can buy, and those have victory points on them.
Nice.
And when the kaiju attack, they destroy some of your tableau of your assets.
Mm-hmm.
So those back into the middle so people can buy them, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really neat, clever little game. Eric Vogel is the designer there. He's done a couple of other games for Evil Hat. And one of the things I really, really like about his game design is he has very interesting, non-traditional economies in play and the way that players are able to use resources, gain resources, or how the resources are a communal pool, that sort of thing.
Okay.
So there's definitely some of that in the card game. In the RPG, the players will be playing one of the ground units that goes in to clean up after kaiju attacks. And they'll also have to deal with the, like, back at the office corporate stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of, like, Ghostbusters in there
mm-hmm.
because nobody really wants to be, you know, first on the scene after a kaiju attack unless they're desperate or crazy.
Right.
So those are the types of people that you get in on your first response teams. And that's looking to be, like, a lot of fun.
Very cool. I'm looking forward to that.
Rob did a job. And the last thing I want to talk about, because this is very recent, is actually I still need to get the contract signed and everything. But I'm going to be writing a supplement for Bulldogs,
mm-hmm.
The Fate sci-fi RPG, that will be all about the homeworlds of all the player character races and other worlds in that area.
Oh, very cool. So less rules and is that more fluff?
There will be sort of like planet aspects and NPCs and describing the planet, writing the fluff, but also providing plot hooks and adventure seeds, that sort of thing.
That's awesome. So it sounds like you've got a lot of things going kind of all at the same time.
Yeah, it does.
A little bit busy. That's okay. That's a good way to be.
And I have a day job, so that's great.
Oh, well, I mean, yes, it is. It is great, but it does take a lot of time. Do you sleep?
Not as much as I would like at times.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a few steps backward and go time travel a little bit to talk about Heroes Fall, because I kind of want to start at the beginning with this. You do a really good job of keeping a process journal, a development blog on your website, so people can go back and kind of see where you were back in, you know, 2012 with the initial conception of this idea. And at its inception, Heroes Fall was pretty much a straight Apocalypse World mod, right?
Yeah, I like to describe it as the contradiction of terms in terms of a very traditional Apocalypse World hack. it hewed very closely to there's an MC, there are playbooks, you have characters with different motivations and agendas that drive play, and their drives will cause inter-party conflict, et cetera, et cetera. And that initially was the direction I took it. The whole concept of it actually stems from my introduction to the Apocalypse World engine was a game of Dungeon World,
mm-hmm.
Run by Kevin Weiser, who did the Walking Eye podcast for a number of years. And I had never gotten interested in Apocalypse World because everybody tried selling it to me based off of the thematic qualities of, oh, it's, you know, leather-bound bikers and crazy, wild, angry sex and this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, you know, I'm not a big fan of the post-apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
The people trying to scrabble out in existence after the bomb falls or whatever has never been my thing. I like to say that I need hope in my fiction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, you know, there tends to be a bit of a lack of that in most post-apocalyptic fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So people kept trying to pull me in with that. If they had instead told me that Apocalypse World is this self-perpetuating drama engine, I would have been much more hooked. Because the way Apocalypse World works is the moves feed the fiction, which leads to new moves. It's the whole snowball effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's phenomenal. So I played Dungeon World and I was like, you know, this is really cool, but it's not exactly what I would want in a fantasy version of Apocalypse World. Because I would love to play a game where I can actually be Conan the Barbarian. You know, in D20 games, you can make a character sheet that has, you know, massive hit points and huge pluses to hit and it says Conan on the character sheet. But at the end of the day, it doesn't feel like you're Conan. You're not picking up a discarded bone and cleaving someone's skull in twain.
Yeah, it's, he's a very distinct character, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't get that from existing games. That's what I wanted to do with Heroes Fall, is have that sort of pulpy, gritty, visceral character in play. And part of the problem with that is Conan was never really big on team-ups, unless you watched the 90s cartoon in which he had like this whole cadre of awesome people who hung out with him and they went on adventures. Like,
it was a very good show. Yeah.
It was fun, you know, and, but as introductions to Tarzan go, it was Conan go, it's probably not the most accurate as far as the bulk of the material. So I also wanted to, you know, avoid the, we're, hooray for us, we're on a quest mentality of a party game. So I started putting together Heroes Fall, which is sort of a dark fantasy, sword and sandal, sword and sorcery RPG. And I have playbooks written up that are things like the Beastmaster, which is Beastmaster from the 80s, the Barbarian, which is Conan, the Chieftain, which is sort of the leader of this unruly horde of warriors. I made a Druid class that was actually more based on how the Druids of actual Celtic mythology and lore would be, which is they were the keepers of truths and secrets and that sort of thing. I wrote up all these different splat books and ran a few play tests and they went really well, but they weren't really doing what I wanted. I was muddling that over. And then I ran a play test that went horrifically, so incredibly bad and so far off the rails that it was painful to look at that manuscript. So I set it off to the side for a few years, and at some point I came to the idea that this shouldn't be a one GM multiple players game. I should flip that and invert it, where you have one PC and multiple GMs.
Right.
Because again, going back to the idea that Conan is not a member of a party of adventurers. He is a singular hero. But that can get kind of boring at the table.
I was going to ask you, so you took it to having multiple GMs and one player character. Did you ever consider doing it in the style of games where there are multiple players playing the one character? And if so, why was that not viable? Just curious.
I have not approached it from that perspective, at least partially because I haven't played any games in that style.
Fair enough.
Also, I think for my own druthers and the type of game that I would enjoy, I am much more interested in having a character that I control, that I can become more invested in, rather than the inside out, we're all vying for control of one character. That's going to be a different dynamic.
Exactly,
That's going to be, I mean, it's still, the game, as I envision it, will still be sort of a balancing conflict between the GMs and the players, GMs and the player, or really what I should say is all the players at the table, but it's different when you have a character or you are controlling an outside force that is affecting that character rather than sort of a removed meta level of we are trying to decide which one of us gets to control this one person.
Yeah, and Conan as a character doesn't really strike me as somebody who has a lot of internal conflict going on.
He doesn't. You know, in a few stories, he's a little torn briefly when he comes across things in society that he sees and doesn't understand or doesn't approve of because of his barbarous background. But he gets over that pretty quick and decides, you know what? No, I have a moral compass. I'm going to stick to it. And then just chops some dude's head off. And it's all good.
Yeah, of course. Because he's Conan. He can do that. The playtests that you had where this initial version of the game went well, do you see that being viable as a different game on its own? Just like a fantasy-flavored Apocalypse World?
Yeah, I think so. But I'm not interested in doing that just sort of fantasy-flavored Apocalypse World.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have some friends who are already making that game.
Oh, cool.
Like, they already have that game. It's further along in development and better polished than what I have at this point in time. And that's from Wheeltree Press. Todd and Megan there. Well, actually, it's Todd and one of his friends are doing The Sword, the Crown, and the Unspeakable Power.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And you can hear, I believe you can hear actual plays of this, if not actual plays, but discussion of it on the Jankcast,
cool.
on their podcast feed. And that's a really cool game because it's basically, you know, what Vampire Dark Ages is to Vampire. This is, you know, fantasy version of Apocalypse World in a lot of ways. And that's a great game, and it works, and it does what it needs to do.
Yeah.
But that's not the game I want to make.
Yeah.
Because if I want to do the adventuring fantasy game, well, I've got Dungeon World. If I want to do the more politics and backstabby stuff, I can always pull out Scup, and that'll be great. But I want to make the game that is not post-apocalyptic, but as I've been describing it, pre-apocalyptic. Because the big narrative conceit in Heroes Fall is the world is at its apogee. It has reached its greatest heights, your civilization has.
Mm-hmm.
Problem with that, there is nowhere to go but down. So from the moment you started the campaign, your campaign is a ticking time bomb. It is hurtling toward catastrophe, and civilization is going to be all but wiped out. That's going to be the end of the campaign. That's just the way the game is going to work. Because through advancement, which at least thus far, and I'm for the most part, I think I'm going to keep this. I just need to find ways to have non-PC players advance at the same rate. Okay, so I'm going to back up a moment. When I say it's one PC and multiple GMs,
mm-hmm.
that's each session. But every player at the table will create a character.
Mm.
But in any given session, or maybe faster, maybe any given scene, only one PC will be played. The other players will take the role of some outside forces that are affecting the world.
Okay.
So the
player characters that they're creating, are they all some type of Conan, or are they still picking from, like, you made that list of different types of characters? You know, you had the druid, you had the cleric, and what have you. Are they picking from that, or are they all playing their own Conan, more or less?
I want it to be that they're picking from a larger list of archetypes.
Okay.
They aren't all going to be the slayer coming in from, you know, the hinterlands and decrying the softness of civilization.
Well, that's good. Get some variety in there.
Yeah, that variety is important. So that's the structure. So at any given point in time, only one PC will be active, but all of the players can be active is the design goal I'm reaching for. But advancement in that very Apocalypse World feel has different tiers. The first tier is all about improving yourself as a character.
Okay.
And building up your immediate circle of community. The second tier is about growing that community and having a larger effect on the world, and includes the option to protect one thing unique to your playbook from the fall. So when civilization ends, if you have chosen this option, when the fall happens and people describe it, this one thing that you pick remains. It survives into the next stage.
Hmm. Is that like a place or a person or whatever you want?
It's going to depend.
Okay.
So for like the thief or, you know, a thief archetype,
mm-hmm.
it can be a great treasure. Like, okay. If you steal a thing and you're like, no, this is what I want to survive and have my legend attached to it, when you advance, you can take that option. say this is what survives. And then the third tier is going to be competitive. The third tier is there are going to be a set number of options. And when one person checks off an option, everyone else crosses it out. They have to be taken in order. Mm-hmm. And when that bottom option gets checked off, the campaign ends, the fall happens, and the person who marked that gets to describe what that is.
Ooh, so it's kind of a race then at the end.
Yes.
Interesting.
So I'm still working out how I can mitigate the race. So it's not just I rack up XP so that I can get to the third tier before anyone else and just churn down that path when, you know, everybody else is still stuck in the early stages of the second tier.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want it to be somewhat competitive so that people are aware of and vying for these juicy things. And the third tier, each option there is going to be about what happens during the fall and protecting different things or declaring that certain things will be destroyed, that sort of thing. So overall, on a very large meta campaign level, Heroes Fall is a game where I want to force people to build the world through play. A lot of their moves will involve world building and see how much investment I can get them to put into the world, mm-hmm. all the while knowing that they're going to have to tear it down and kill their darlings at the end of it.
That's so, you're so mean. I really like that.
But like that's a story that really interests me. It's not what happens afterward. I don't care, whatever. People can live in squalor and filth for all I care.
And they probably do based on all the post-apocalyptic media we've got. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But that doesn't interest me. Mm. I want to see what happens leading up to this. Like, how did we get there? And what were people doing in those end times? Because the conceit of the player characters is that they are uniquely powerful, effective people in the world. They can make greater changes than common schlubs. They're not going to be beggars in the street. They're going to be Conan, who rises from a common thief to ruling the largest kingdom in the known world. These are who you're playing. What are they doing? Because the characters can see the writing on the wall, and the players know the writing on the wall. Like they're helping write it. So how many hearts can I break as I force them to fall in love with NPCs and then slaughter them mercilessly as I burn entire cities to the ground?
I think you're going to break everyone's heart. I think that's what's going to happen.
But I'm
so ready to play.
Right. And that's the experience I'm looking for, is I want people to be like, man, that's going to suck, but that sounds like a good, interesting journey.
Yeah. So. Yeah, because I'm definitely with you on the whole, like, the post-apocalypse is too bleak, and I like having some hope, and I think the allure of this game to me is maybe I'll get to save that one thing that I really like. Like, maybe yes. I'll be able to do that.
Yep, and that's kind of my hope, and the idea with the last person checking off the last box is that person gets to decide, is it a tidal wave? Is it a meteor that hits? Is it, you know, the bubonic plague, what goes on,
yeah.
what happens, do the gods just get that fed up with humanity and, like, walk amongst us, slaughtering us? I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's cool. That's something interesting and, I hope, compelling to other people.
Yeah, I think it will be. So the players who are not currently a protagonist for the evening, are they going to be then playing like the NPCs? What types of things do they get to do as an AGM?
So I haven't quite worked out how this is all going to work.
Fair enough.
But basically I'm going to have a number of GM playbooks. So GMs in Apocalypse World games are given a list of hard moves and principles
mm-hmm.
that they work with. And part of the way I imagine it right now, part of campaign creation is setting up interesting forces at work in the world. So if you're playing Cthulhu or playing Conan, which has some Cthulhu elements to it, You can have the cults of the elder gods, or you could have the snake priests of Set and that sort of thing. And divide up those different aspects into playbooks. And each GM grabs a playbook that has a slightly different set of agendas and principles.
Hmm.
So if you are playing a playbook that represents the forces of civilization, so the king and his royal guards and his court and the army, you have one set of guidelines of what your NPCs that you can just create as you want, what your NPCs do and how they react to the players, that will be different from somebody who's playing the representative of the gods.
Mm.
You know, because the priests and the cults are going to act differently than the king and his court. And they have not only different agendas in the story, but they have a different purpose in the narrative. So that's what the GM playbooks will be, is guidelines for how to play compelling antagonism. The different GM playbooks will provide guidelines on how to provide meaningful antagonism and narratively appropriate antagonism to the PC, whoever the PC happens to be at that point in time. And the GM playbooks can be shuffled about. You don't have to play the same one every time. You just sort of grab it and go.
Do you have like a target number in mind for how many you think you need? Because that's...
I think I would like to borrow a page out of Fiasco's book and 3 to 5.
Nice. That's a good size group.
It is. That, and any larger than that, especially since I'm trying to get everyone into every scene, if possible, gets a little unwieldy. But, and oh god, I could go on about how much I love Fiasco time and time again. But part of the beauty of that game, having its target range of players be 3 to 5, is by the time you get outside of that range with 6, you just split off and have 2 games.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. It's like the perfect convention game in that sense. Like, oh, okay, I had one extra person show up. Who here has played it before? As long as one other person has played Fiasco before, you can just hand them some note cards, hand them a play set, and be like, all right, you guys just play it at that end of the table.
Mm-hmm.
We'll play at this end of the table. It'll be great. So it's that same sort of thing.
Cool. I think that's a good goal. So this multiple GMs idea, how did you come across that as a possible solution?
I think I actually wrote a blog post about this.
I think you did, but...
I came about this idea because, for whatever reason, I was really, really prolific writing the original version of Heroes Fall, even back when it was still called Grimworld, which I would like to point out, it was called Grimworld before they had that Kickstarter for... adventure setting called Grimworld, and I changed it before they came out with it, but I was still pissed because, damn it, I came up with that first.
Yeah, I think one of your earliest posts does keep referencing it as Grimworld, so you've got evidence.
Yeah. Anyway,
yeah.
I was really, really prolific writing that while I was watching on Netflix the Highlander TV show.
Nice.
Which is something that, like, in the 90s I was aware of, but I never managed to really catch with any regularity. And I like some of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the movies are just trash because, like, that's just the nature of some of those movies. But I really, really love the first one. So it's just like, I'll give the TV show a shot. And since I'm a designer, I can't not design for media that I'm consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So I started mulling over ideas of how Highlander TV show would work in a game. Just like, well, I guess I could have everybody be an immortal, but that would be a really short game.
Yeah.
Because, like, everybody's just going to be like, oh, another immortal. I bust out my sword and start trying to chop off his head. And that's not what I wanted. You know, if I wanted a just pure PC PvP combat game, I'd make a Mortal Kombat RPG or something, right? Like, that's not what I want to do. So I came up with the idea that, you know, you have one immortal, but then all the other players, you know, there can be only one, but the immortals aren't islands. They don't exist on their own.
Mm-hmm.
They have mortal entanglements. They have lovers and pupils and friends, you know, and that's a big part of the show is how do you deal with outliving everyone you love and going on beyond what any of them could ever hope to achieve. So I was just like, well, I could have mortal lovers and friends, and there's the Watchers, which are just a great narrative concept, and then the antagonist immortal of the week. And those can be the GM roles. So I modeled it after a couple of episodes in the show where, like, it's so great. I always forget his name. The lead singer from The Who played an immortal in the television series.
Oh, my God.
Actually, they were known for this. They brought in a bunch of rock stars to play immortals throughout the series. Like, Joan Jett was in an episode or three.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah. So, anyway, lead singer from The Who played actually my favorite immortal. Just sort of this whimsical, happy-go-lucky guy. And he was framed for murder and, you know, showed up on Duncan's boat in Paris trying to hide from mortal authorities. And Duncan's girlfriend is just like, we have to help him. And he's just like, are you kidding me? Like, this could expose me, blah, blah, blah. And the Watchers showed up and there were cops outside. And like, I'm like, oh, this is perfect. Like, all of my players are in this scene right now.
Yeah.
So after I had that horrible crash and burn, and once I could go back and look at Heroes Fall, I was just like, you know what? That's actually what I want. I want the one hero with other things going on around them, because that's the inspiration, that's sort of the form of the fiction that I'm trying to emulate. You know, sort of that pulp adventure thing with Conan and Beastmaster, and even Tarzan to a degree.
Mm.
Since I referenced Tarzan earlier, we'll just throw that back in there.
Yeah, it was totally intentional.
It was.
So, something that comes up in role-playing a lot is the GM is not supposed to be your enemy. You know, he's not there to make your life hell. It kind of sounds like, to a certain extent, some of these GMs are actively trying to antagonize at least one player in that evening. So how does that reconcile, do you think?
Well, the big thing is the GM isn't supposed to make your life, the player, miserable. The GM is supposed to make your life, the PC, interesting. And there needs to be a differentiation between those two things. Because you can provide interesting, meaningful conflict for the player, or the PC,
mm-hmm.
without blocking the player. Because the player sort of will describe their intent and what they want to do. And then the GM, it's always the GM's role to make the story of how to get there or not the most interesting it can be. Because, I'm trying to think of a good example here. Well, I mean, let's look at a classic D&D example. Like, you break into the room, there's a bunch of goblins, and there's a chest at the back of the room. Your D&D player just says, well, I want everything in that chest, so I have to kill all the goblins first. And 12 rounds of combat later, the player can finally try to open up the chest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in D&D, the interesting challenge there is the goblins. That's what you had to overcome. In a game like Dungeon World, the interesting challenge can be not necessarily killing the goblins, but taking whatever is in the chest. Because there's the difference because Dungeon World has the move where you can, oh, I forget the actual name for it, but it's seize by force in Apocalypse World.
Yeah.
Because the difference between D&D and Apocalypse World is, Apocalypse World, you can just say, I want that chest. And I threaten the goblins at the point of my sword for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all just resolved with one roll. And if you get, you know, a 7 to 9, the GM gets a choice to make. Now, the lazy option is to do harm back to the player.
Right.
That's the simplest, it's the most straightforward, but it's very rarely the most interesting or the most dramatic. Now, if the player was already hurt, and that would put them like one or two ticks away from being completely fucked up in Apocalypse World mm-hmm. terms.
They're good
that
terms.
Might be interesting, right? Like yeah. that could be like, oh, okay. Well, now that's the cost in blood that you're paying for this chest. Now you're almost completely fucked up and you are way, way deep in this dungeon. What's going to happen to you? That could be the most interesting thing. Or you could say, you can totally just point your sword at the goblins, and they're like, yeah, we're not going to deal with this, but they're going to remember it, and you indicate future badness. Like, you're not feeling up for this fight right now, neither are they, mm-hmm. but they have friends in this dungeon, and you don't, right? So that's what the GM should be doing, is they should be providing interesting, meaningful, fun conflict, not just straight up blocking people.
Cool. So even though there's a gang of DMs, or GMs, they should be making it fun.
Right. And cool. One of the things I'm going to need to very carefully outline and delineate is only one GM gets to respond at a given dice roll, right? Like, you can't just have the GMs gang piling on when somebody rolls a 7 and 9.
Yeah.
That, one, isn't fun, but two, and almost more important, isn't sort of the ass-kicking, name-taking, heroic fantasy I'm going for.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like that would be in the spirit of it. So, the player characters, so they won't necessarily be active in each session, but do you see them crossing paths or overlapping in any way as these stories unfold?
That's something that has crossed my mind, and I don't have a good solution for it yet. Because as I've been laying this out as this singular PC multi-GM game, mm-hmm. I haven't come up with a good way to take one of those GMs out and slide in a second PC. I'm not ruling it out. It could absolutely happen, but I haven't come up with a solid way to handle it yet.
Cool. So you did some playtesting for the initial version of this game. Have you been doing any testing with this new multiple GM one player style version?
Not yet. It's not ready.
Yeah. Okay.
I will be, because yeah. even more than Three Rocketeers, which was my first sort of creator-led and gone-to-completion project, this is my baby. Like, this is the one that I really, really want to get right, mm-hmm. and I think could have a really strong impact on the community if I get it right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doing that is going to be a slow and careful and steady process. But it hasn't stopped people from, so in Chicago, I'm lucky enough that there are other game designers, including.
Just a few.
Including Ken Height and Will Height in March. And those two have a monthly get together here in Chicago. It's actually tomorrow this month.
Oh, cool.
For Chicago area game writers. Where we get together, we have dinner, have a few beers, and it's all good fun. I was describing this to them when I first started showing up, and they're just like, wow, that sounds really great. Are you going to write a follow-up game where people are then taking the seeds of what you saved from the fall of humanity and building a new civilization? I'm like, guys, hold on, can I finish the one game? And then we'll talk about the follow-up to it? Like, so... it hasn't stopped people from being like, yeah, and then you should totally do this other thing. So hurry up and finish this one so we can get to this other one that we're asking about that is predicated upon being able to finish that. And I'm like, but I haven't even finished this one. Like, oh, okay.
Let him get done with destroying the world first, and then we can talk about it.
Yeah, and then you can rebuild it.
See what's left over in the aftermath, and then take it from there.
Yeah, so... That would be a neat game. Because again, that's a more hopeful version of the post-apocalypse than you typically see.
Yeah, and then that really does give a lot of extra weight to people's decisions in the first part of the game, what they're saving, and if they're able to do it. So that's a really cool idea.
Yeah, and then you can just chain together alternating campaigns. To destroy the world and build it up, and destroy the world and build it up, and destroy the world and build it up.
That's terrible, and I love it.
I would love 10 years from now to hear from people who have gone through a full 5 cycles, and just hear what their world is like. That would be fascinating.
That would be. I'd be curious to see if something survives multiple apocalypses.
Apocalypse.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, that would be really, really cool. But I've got to write this first one before I can learn.
Yeah, you do. And we're keeping you from it. Do you have any kind of a timeline goal for Heroes Fall now that you're back into it?
I don't. Especially, like, I just picked up, you know, a 40,000 word project that I need to finish by March 1st. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't know. I guess it all depends on how the freelancing schedule goes, because, you know, the ones that bring in money are going to, you know, take a little bit of precedence over the ones where I don't potentially ever see any money. So,
oh, definitely.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who have self-published their games and have their own imprints and whatnot, and I'm just like, no, that is way too much work for me. So my idea is, I'll write this game and then I'm going to shop it around and, like, see if anybody wants to publish it, because, yay. And I think we've reached a point in the industry where people would be interested, like, known publishers, like, Pinnacle or Palgrain or Evil Hat or whomever would be interested in picking up this weird little RPG, you know, that has sex and violence all out the wazoo. And, you know, if I had my art directing, chops, it would be full on Frazetta-esque painting for the cover. Like, just, you know, dripping blades and naked people everywhere, because that's the source material. That's what I'm looking for.
Well, we're looking forward to it, whatever form it takes.
As am I. I am hopeful. Now that I've sort of gotten over the emotional scarring of, like, oh my god, that is the worst game I have ever run, ever. I'm feeling much more hopeful about it, and I'm excited about the new direction it could take.
Awesome. Yeah, having that time to get some distance from it, that helps.
The healing process could have been faster than 3 years, but you know.
Well, all in our own time.
Right.
Has it changed the way you look at how you'll play test it in the future?
Oh, yeah. I mentioned this on Talking Tabletop, Jim McClure's show.
We know
and,
him.
Yeah, I was going to say he's part of this whole one-shot network. I mentioned to him that I would really love to find a good, solid GM that I know to run the games for playtests. Because I have a lot of social anxiety, and I have troubles running a table and being the forceful, like, this is what we're doing, we're staying on task, you know, sort of authoritarian at the table, which runs into some issues when you're like, no, this is, come on guys, you need to get back on task, that's not what this game does. You know, I'll clarify that in the rules, but stay on target. So I would love to find somebody who can GM things. Like, I'll write the games, and I can run the occasional session, but I don't think I am emotionally or socially equipped necessarily to be the person running the playtests.
Yeah, it takes a very strong personality. That's something I noticed at Metatopia this last year. The different types of folks that we had running games, it really struck me. You know, some of them are clearly better equipped and to run those games and to get what they want out of them.
Yeah, and actually Metatopia is the one place where I would feel comfortable just running it for strangers, because I can say on the Metatopia forum as a designer, no, I only want other designers, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going in and there are other designers who understand what's going on, that's an immediate level of understanding that I don't have with randos off the street.
Right, so. Yeah. They understand what it takes to build a game and hopefully what you're hoping to get out of it. So
right.
Maybe some Metatopia soon.
Hopefully. I don't know how much Metatopia or any conventions are in the cards for me in the next 2 years, but that's hopefully. If I go to any in the next few years, it's going to be Metatopia.
Cool. That one's near me. You should do that. I'm going to play this game.
I had a great time at Metatopia last year, 2014, 2015.
Mm-hmm.
That was a blast. I had hoped to go in 2015, but I did not plan properly according to budget, vacation time, or writing. in order to go. So
yeah, that's fair. That I only managed to go this year last minute because it is so close. There's literally a commuter train that I could take. So it's like, all right, let's go.
Whereas I took a train to a plane to a bus to a commuter train, I think is how that all worked.
Probably.
Yeah. I got into Newark Airport, and then I had to find my way to your commuter train.
Yeah.
Which dropped me off in.
Which is the worst.
It wasn't too bad. The timing was it was only like 20 minutes on the platform waiting for the commuter train.
Cool.
So
good job, New Jersey Transit.
Yeah.
Well, we do have a couple of listener questions.
Hmm.
I say listener even though the first episode doesn't come out for another 2 days, but I'm going to call them listeners.
As well you should.
Yes.
So, be bold and presumptuous.
They are listeners and they have questions for you. So this one is a little lengthy. You'll have to bear with me.
Sure.
It's from one of the Reddit users, Sarazan, and their question is, Apocalypse World does not, by design, contain modifiers for opposition and difficulty. For example, Seize by Force only depends on the character's hard, not on the opponent's status or the situation at hand. So assaulting a heavily defended bunker statistically has the same odds of success as punching a child to get its candy. Please, please don't do that in your games. As the custom moves section points out, difficulty tends to make the game less fun. The question is, what are good thematic ways, not just giving a -2, to add a sense of difficulty when playing in a setting where tasks have a much larger difficulty disparity? Is that something that you think is an obstacle in Hero's Fall? Do you find that there are different tasks the hero could be doing that have such a widely disparate level of difficulty that you would need to address that?
Actually, yes. In the original version, I was working with what I called scale rules. Mm-hmm. And the scale rules determined how big of an effect you could have. Because one of the playbooks was effectively Thulsa Doom, right? The cult leader out there gaining followers and power and dark majesty. That was one of the playbooks. You could play that character. But finding a way to balance that with Conan is kind of a weird thing. So the scale rules, as I originally laid them out, and I haven't looked at them yet for this this newer version, the scale rules controlled how large of an effect you can have on any given role. So at lower scale, you can affect one or two other people, and it would move up to a room full of people, to a crowd, to a large crowd, et cetera, until finally at the very end of the campaign, because it was tied to the number of advancements you had,
mm-hmm.
very end of the campaign, you could have a global effect. So if you've got 14 advancements under your belt, you can be Thulsa Doom and just like send your horde of angry assassins out into the world to destroy another kingdom.
Nice.
So that was one way I was looking at how to do it. And things beyond your scale, simply you cannot accomplish. You have to rework your narrative into something that you can accomplish. The other thing is there are some great lines in Apocalypse World, that include things like trade harm for harm as established.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're assaulting a heavily fortified bunker, the harm coming back at you is going to be established as pretty damn severe.
Yeah.
So that can be your hard move, right? Or that can be even, that's not even a hard move, really. Like, that's in Seize by Force, that's on a 7-9. Like, you have to get a 10+ before you avoid damage. Like, so it's what, like 80% of the time, if you have a +1, you're just going to take a ton of damage. Oof. So look at that and be like, well, you can go all Don Quixote and charge this thing, but it's going to smack you back for like 5 harm. Oh, wait, whoa, 5 harm?
Mm.
Yeah. Oh, well, maybe not, you know, and that all comes down really to play dynamic and social interaction and working with the players at your table to establish a fiction that is plausible for everyone, because these games are social constructs. Everyone needs to be on board with what is happening in order for it to work. So that, I think, is where that all comes in, is use the social constructs at the table to be like, I don't think that would really happen. And the, if you need to, the rules of the game to back up the threat posed by that action.
Cool. Those are good approaches. I hope that helps Sarazan.
As do I.
Keeps them from punching children.
Yeah, who does that?
He's playing a different game, I think.
Yeah.
We have one more from Reddit. Reddit user Weekend at Bernie's. So now this one, I'm going to see how this goes. So they want to know, certain sci-fi games seem easily adaptable to RPG, such as Star Wars and Firefly. Are there certain sci-fi games that are just not adaptable, or certain sci-fi genres, sorry, that are just not adaptable to an RPG, specifically Star Trek? This person, Weekend at Bernie's, really wants to know about Star Trek RPGs, possibly based on Apocalypse World, and I know you're a Star Wars person.
I actually also really like Star Trek.
Okay, good.
You know, the
we don't
world
have to
has,
fight.
No, the world has progressed to the point where you can be a fan of both. You know, we're no longer the sharks and the jets snapping down the hallways at each other of you know, Gen Con or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So my first reaction is, I'm sure Ken Height would disagree with you that Star Trek won't make a good RPG, because Ken Height has written two Star Trek RPGs back-to-back, actually.
There you go.
He went from writing one for one company and then went and wrote a second one, like, the next year for, I think it was Unicorn Games. I'm not sure.
Oh, nice.
But that is an amusing story. If you can ever flag him down at a convention, ask him about the time that he wrote back-to-back Star Trek RPGs.
I will absolutely ask him that.
And let's see here. He did an interview podcast episode about that. It may have been the Bear Swarm or Genosotes. That's okay. About the time I was listening to those shows. So there's that. And then there is a little micro game based on Star Trek. Or no, not a micro. Well, I mean, yes, there's the micro game, Lasers and Feelings, which, you know, if you want to have a smoochy time with the captain, that's the game you play.
Who doesn't?
Tell this user, go to critical-hits.com. So that's critical-hits.com.
Mm-hmm.
And search for Strange New Worlds. It is an Apocalypse World hack for Star Trek.
Perfect.
It is unlicensed, but it is Apocalypse Engine, Star Trek style, drama. That said, I have also played a Fate version of Star Trek that was really pretty cool. This is the great thing about Fate, is we can build our own stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So based on some conversations I'd had online, my group at the time was in between games. And we were just like, oh, what do we want to play next? And the idea of a Star Trek game came up. So they're like, oh, are there any licensed ones? We don't really want to buy new games. I'm like, but we have Fate. We could do that. So we made we used the modes version of Fate, which can be found in the Fate toolkit. Also demonstrated beautifully in Atomic Robo. And our modes were based on the different divisions of Starfleet. So we had Command, Science, Ops, Security, Engineering, and Medical. And we arranged skills under those modes, and it worked out really, really well. So I absolutely think Star Trek is very much a gameable IP. It's kind of weird, though, because Star Trek is very different things to people all around. Because the fans of the original series are looking for different things from fans of Next Generation, who are looking for different things than the fans of Deep Space Nine. So it's, again, going to come down to the social contract and asking, what do we want this game to do? What do we want technology to act as in our game? Like, what is its narrative function? Which, to me, science is the explanation of our problems and possibly the solution to the problems, but not always. Because sometimes the solution is diplomatic. So I absolutely think that Star Trek is a gameable IP, something you can do. You just have to go out and do it. So there's the Star Trek role-playing game that was published by Decipher. That was the first one.
Yeah, I think that's the one I came across when I did just a quick search.
And the other one is from Last Unicorn Games.
Perfect.
So
that's very hopeful news to all the that we got into quite a discussion in the thread. It kind of took off on a how to play a Star Trek RPG tangent. So this will be great.
But no, I hopefully those answers will prove illuminating for Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah, I think so. They'll have something to do other than what they're currently doing. So speaking of science fiction RPGs, you had one other project on your website. You were working on a Mass Effect RPG.
I was. I should state up front, this was not the Mass Effect RPG that got fan published and erroneously nominated for awards.
Oh.
That was not me.
I ask because the show that is going to air right before yours, in the schedule for me, actually, I talked to somebody who's homebrewing a Mass Effect RPG, and we talked about there are a lot of other homebrewed Mass Effect RPGs. Like, any system you can think of has a Mass Effect
pretty
mod.
Much.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that is there's no official one.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason for that is the powers that be at BioWare aren't interested in an official one.
Really?
Yeah.
Which seems strange. The Dragon Age one exists to
I know.
Reasonable
and,
acclaim.
I've spoken with some people at Green Ronin who do the Dragon Age one. They're just like, yeah, we've asked. We're like, hey, hi, we love that game too. And they're just not interested in a Mass Effect RPG.
That's
not
interesting.
Tabletop. Yeah, so I thought that was a bit different. I wrote a bunch of stuff on that using the Cortex Plus system. Actually, it was mostly modeled off of Cortex Plus Heroic, which was first shown in Marvel Heroic, which is a phenomenal game. Highly, highly, highly recommend it. Its end came entirely too soon, but I think where mine differs from a lot of other hacks out there is that mine, to a large degree, focused on the relationships between characters, between player characters. And that was part of your dice pool that you built up. Also part of your dice pool was your Paragon and Renegade ratings, which, and the way I designed it, those were diametrically opposed. So as you built up one, the other had to go down. You could never max out both Paragon and Renegade.
Perfect.
You could only, in order to, I think they both started at D6. And if you wanted a D8 Paragon, no, they started at D8s. If you wanted a D10 Paragon, you had to drop Renegade down to D6. And if you wanted a D12 Paragon, you had to drop Renegade down to D4.
Perfect.
So it meant that you leaned heavier in one area, but it also meant that your options for doing out-of-character actions were somewhat limited.
Yeah, well, which emulates the games pretty well, I would say.
So your character relationship was one of the pools, one of the dice that could get added to your pool, which I was hoping would drive teamwork. So that as you go along and help each other or, you know, lay down covering fire or move in as a team, as you have a stronger relationship with other players, you are better at doing that. You are literally better as working as a team than you are alone.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a really nice approach, I think, to simulating that. Because we talked about that a little bit on the other episode, how relationships are such an integral part of the video games. Like, how do you do that in a tabletop role-playing game, outside of just role-playing it?
Right. The problem I ran into with that was I never came up with a good reason to give somebody a lower die rating. Like, there was never any reason to not just bump up all your relationships.
Gotcha.
As long as you had the XP and you could do it, blah, blah, blah. There was never a reason to be like, well, but it's more interesting if we have this conflicted relationship that's just, you know, a D6, or maybe even we don't get along, but that gives us some sort of story mojo of some sort. So, like, I never found a reason to be like, yeah, you should totally have this D4 relationship with Caden because that guy's whiny and you don't like him, you know? Or you don't have a good relationship with Ashley because she's this weird, crazy, space racist person.
Yeah.
And she always gets nuked on Vermeier if I'm playing. That's just me. But so it's a really fascinating story to try and emulate.
Yeah.
I think I hit a pretty good balance on the combat aspect and modeling the different special powers and things like that, particularly how you lower an enemy's shields or armor, I thought worked out really well and prevented people from basically spamming defensive abilities the way that you could in Marvel Heroic. In Marvel Heroic, defense is an incredibly privileged position because you are working with both with known information,
mm-hmm.
like you know what the other person rolled and what you have to beat, but also they had invulnerability, which for the cost of a single plot point, you could ignore physical stress unless it was caused by this one thing. So a lot of Marvel Heroic fights came down to, well, I have to find that one thing this person is weak to and then just clobber them with it as much as I can. So I worked out a way where, like, your shields get weaker as you go throughout a battle, that sort of thing.
Cool. If nothing else, their reluctance to make a licensed RPG has given rise to some really cool interpretations of how to do it.
Yep.
So, very cool. All right, so the most important question of all. How many times have you seen Star Wars The Force Awakens?
I have seen it 7 times.
That is amazing.
And I would like to point out that today is the 12th of January.
Mm-hmm. It's been out for almost a month.
Almost a month. I have not seen Star Wars The Force Awakens in 2016.
Oh my gosh. I
have
no idea.
I have not seen it this year.
How are you holding up?
I've gotten to the point where I'm starting to think this whole illness is my body being like, you need to go see the movie again.
Yeah.
Which is just a wonderful, wonderful justification to do it.
I think so. Take a sick day, see the movie, feel better. It's good. So, I like it.
I did take a sick day yesterday, and I was very tempted to go see it again. But then I didn't want to be the plague bringer who, like, you know, like, wipes out half the city because I went and saw a matinee, you know?
Oh, well, that's very considerate of you. I'm sorry it's been a hard year.
Yeah. Oh. Well, instead I took a 4-hour nap in the middle of the day.
That's good. I think it'll be in theaters for a while yet.
For a while, yeah. You know, a couple more days.
I still have to see it this year, so. Saw it last year.
And I know. You were like, okay, so this whole Star Wars thing, not so bad.
Not the worst. It's pretty cute.
What other things might I want to look into if I liked this one?
And yeah. Yeah. Tell me what books to read. Yeah, I have been watching I requested a whole bunch of books, Star Wars and game-related and otherwise that I need, through my local library system, and I just sit here refreshing it because it keeps saying, oh, they're all in transit, and it has like a little truck as they're all coming to this branch, and it's like, you're gonna make me come out 16 different times because they will not all arrive at once.
Right.
And you're just sitting there, I don't know where they're living, where they're holding, they're just on a truck somewhere for a week and a half, I don't know. But yeah, I will let you know as soon as I get to finish one of these books.
I look forward to it.
Yeah.
There's some really good stuff out there. By and large, everything in the new canon has been pretty solid. The first few of the novels were a little shaky, but pretty much for the last year, I'll say, everything has been really, really good.
Cool.
So if you have access to it, Star Wars Rebels is phenomenal. It really, really is.
That's one of the cartoons, right?
Yep. It's okay. The new and currently airing cartoon.
Oh, okay. I think the only ones on Netflix are Clone Wars. Yeah.
Yep. A lot of people feel that way.
I hear some of that is skippable, so we'll see.
The Clone Wars is a series that gets better.
Yes.
The further along it goes. And part of that is because you are building up all of this investment and empathy with the characters of the show. But I agree, there is honestly some skippable material in there. But it, on the whole, it's very, very good. And where else are you going to see a tiny little frog riding around in an astromech, like another little R2-D2? commanding a unit of droids, infiltrating the separatist army to gather secret information.
Okay, that's adorable.
That's a whole story arc, and it's
oh my god,
it's hilarious.
All right, I have to watch these now. And I know people say that about all the time about other media. Oh, you can skip these episodes or this season. I can't. I physically can't do that. So I'll make it. I'll make it through somehow.
Yeah.
And while we're on the subject, just to give our friend of the show, friend of everyone on Twitter, New Type Knight, did ask a couple questions that you answered, but we're going to ask them anyway. Mm-hmm. What color would your lightsaber be?
Green. I have always been a fan of the green lightsaber ever since Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
I don't know why. It may actually be the reason green is my favorite color. I'm not sure. But green is, if I got to pick, my lightsaber would be green.
Nice. I think you get to pick. I think that's how that works.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's determined by the color of the crystal you get.
So pick the green crystal. There you go, right? That's how that works, like, right?
There's this whole spirit quest thing associated with it.
All right.
So it's not necessarily you get to pick the crystal.
I believe your heart and your spirit will lead you to a green crystal.
Rock on.
I think that'll work. And your preferred starfighter?
Oh, God. See, that's the killer question. There are so many of them, and so many of them are just awesome. But I'm going to go for its all-around versatility, the X-Wing.
Nice.
It's heavily armed. It's got bigger and more guns than the A-Wing. It's not as fast or maneuverable as the A-Wing, but it's still fast. It's got some shields, and it carries proton torpedoes. Though the new one from The Force Awakens... Mm-hmm. Its weapons bay is actually modular. Ooh. So you can swap out proton torpedoes, concussion missiles, or this new type of weapon that we don't know what it does, mag pulse warheads. So
that sounds exciting. Big.
It does. It sounds important.
Yeah.
So, yeah, actually, I think I'll go with that. I'll go with the T-70 X-Wing, which is the one in The Force Awakens.
Perfect. I love that you know the number for it.
As opposed to the T-65 from the original trilogy.
And on that note...
I was going to say, my Star Wars nerdery is vast.
Is impressive.
Yeah. I like to joke with my friends that I am now the reigning king of Star Wars trivia in Chicago, because the week before The Force Awakens came out, there was a trivia contest that we showed up to.
Yeah.
And we won that, and that was awesome. And then at The Force Awakens, before The Phantom Menace starts, because we went and did the whole marathon, and the theater manager came out and did some trivia questions. And he's like, all right, so this first question is going to be for a theatrical poster of The Force Awakens. Like, literally, this is one of the ones that they hang up in their lighted boxes.
Those are nice.
And I won that question, and then I abstained from the rest of the questions because I had already won. So I'm just like, you know what? At this point, I am the undisputed king of Star Wars trivia, and that's a title I'm happy to try and defend. So,
all right. Well, so if
bring it, Chicagoans.
Well, so if anybody wants to find you on the internet to find out more about your games or to challenge your title, where can they find you?
I am on Twitter way too much. Mm-hmm. At PK underscore Sullivan. You can find my website is PKSullivan.com. I am on Google Plus as PK Sullivan. No periods in the PK, just PK. And yeah, that's it. I don't use Facebook, so I'm not on that. But yeah, if people want to find me, that's where I am. Yeah, always happy to talk to people.
Especially about Star Wars.
Yeah, well, to be fair, I'll be talking about Star Wars anyway. If people want to join me in that conversation, they're welcome.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for telling us all about your game and talking with me tonight.
Oh, thank you. It's been a blast.
Thanks again to PK for sharing so much about Heroes Fall and his process. I'm starting to feel a little like a game tease with these amazing games that aren't quite out yet, but PK is very sweet and very much on Twitter, so go tell him how excited you are for Heroes Fall, and check out some of his other stuff that's already published. You can find links to his site and his works in the show notes. You can find Modifier on Twitter at Modifier Podcast, or check out the headquarters at modifierpodcast.tumblr.com. Feel free to send questions, comments, or contribution inquiries to modifierpodcast@gmail.com. Some of you sweet folks have reached out that way, and I owe you a response, but I can't wait to talk to you more. Speaking of sweethearts, in the last few weeks, the reviews have appeared on iTunes, and you're all so great. There's a lot of optimism in there for the future of Modifier, and I wholeheartedly share it. You are making this an amazing experience, and I hope to keep delivering. If you haven't rated us yet and would like to, please do. Modifier is proud to be part of the One Shot Podcast Network, an amazing family of games podcasts that include its namesake, One Shot. One Shot gives every RPG a shot 1 week at a time by sharing actual plays of a variety of games played by some of the funniest people around. Find out more at oneshotpodcast.com. Modifier's theme music was created by my favorite Bothan, Kat Greenfield, whose myriad talents are on display at katgreenfield.com. Next time on Modifier, we explore the Cypher system with Bruce Cordell. See you then!